Welcome to Federalist 2.0. This is a new podcast where we explore the ways in which the Constitution, our instruction manual for how to run a government, could be improved. I'm your host, Jeff, and you can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Now, on with the show. In this week's episode, we're exploring how laws will get made in a tricameral system. You're never supposed to study how laws and sausages get made, but it's our unenviable task to get into the weeds on this installment of Federalist 2.0. I also want to give a special shout out to Senator Ben Sasse, who apparently might be a loyal listener. Just this week, he came out in support of removing the popular vote for senators and returning to their appointment. Given that that's not exactly a mainstream thought or idea out there, I think it's only reasonable to assume he got it from listening to Federalist 2.0. So, Senator Ben Sasse, if you're out there, we'd love to have you on the show. You're welcome anytime. And now on with the rest of the show. All right, so with our new tricameral legislature fleshed out from the last episode, at least in the broad generalities, now it's time for us to consider the roles and responsibilities of those three chambers. The process, while important, it's also relatively straightforward. We simply need to ask ourselves which constituency is ultimately the most impacted by each of these powers. So let's take, for example, treaties with foreign governments. This is a power best left to a more deliberative body, so not the House of Representatives. In a more conventional democracy, this would likely fall to the parliament as the impact of a treaty is felt by the entire nation. But as a federalist republic, I think there's a unique role and duty here that more likely falls to the states. Partly I say that because I think it seems ill-conceived to enforce a structure that would allow international treaties to be signed despite a majority of the states being opposed to them. That seems very anti-federalist to me. This does give a certain treaty veto power to the smaller states, but I think in this particular case, that actually seems like it's a positive, not a negative. Impeachment is another big power that obviously we know a lot about from this year. Leaving the power of impeachment itself, essentially the indictment phase of a member of the executive or the judicial branch, to the House makes sense. That's how the current setup works. But trying the impeachment in the Senate doesn't. Impeachment is the most severe political punishment available, and the merits of a particular case shouldn't be decided in a way that weights any one person's vote against another, which is exactly what happens right now by allowing the Senate to conduct the impeachment trial and have that vote. So given that, I think impeachment trials probably ought to be conducted by the parliament as a national decision. And then the last power that's enumerated in the original Constitution is the role of advice and consent. I think this one probably deserves a more meaningful discussion, and we probably will do a whole episode on it, because the role of advice and consent has drifted so far from what the framers had envisioned. But that may be a good thing, maybe not, but we should give it a more careful consideration regardless. My suggestion on that role, though, is to align it with the chambers that we've established and allow advice and consent on things like ambassadors to be left to the Senate, advice and consent on judges, the role that probably most dramatically impacts people's everyday life, should be left with the House, and all other officers of the executive for which congressional approval is required by the parliament should be done by the parliament. So in this way, the right constituencies are approving the right people. I think that makes everything line up relatively neatly. So that takes care of the powers that were originally envisioned and given to Congress in the 1787 Constitution. But what then of new powers? Are there new powers that would be appropriate for these new bodies? And I think the answer to that is a definitive and unequivocal yes. The first power that needs to be enumerated, in my opinion, is that of oversight. People don't realize, but the 1787 Constitution actually makes no mention of oversight. It's been adjudged over time to be an implicit power of the Congress, but that seems really far from compelling and always subject to the judicial winds of the time. Oversight should be made an explicit congressional power, and while the executive may find it frustrating and inefficient to deal with, an executive without meaningful oversight is ultimately far more dangerous and more costly than an inefficient one. Now, perhaps there's some sort of construct that would permit the judiciary to weigh in when the executive feels that the oversight requirements are overburdensome, but any mechanism like that really should be structured to be quick, responsive, and difficult to abuse. Because as we've seen in 2020, there's a seemingly endless fight between the executive and the legislature over the oversight being conducted, and tying up the adjudication of this oversight for 18 or more months at a time doesn't strike me as compelling or necessary, right? Now, there are two other areas of executive power that probably should be devolved back to the legislature. These are things that originally the legislature had much more of a role in, and over time has sort of slowly moved over to the executive. And I think in an attempt to sort of reduce the power of the executive, we should definitely look at these. The first and probably the most prominent is the role of regulation in our modern government. There are those that will suggest regulations and regulatory agencies are a large problem in the economy. I would stipulate that this is true, but that the solution is not to eliminate them altogether. The alternative to regulation is that Congress would need to pass detailed laws about areas that they can't possibly have sufficient expertise in. Regulations are, unfortunately, the best alternative here, but that means that the problems with regulation is that they rarely get cleaned up and modernized, and we need to have a mechanism for that. So they can sit on the books, creating problems, but without the political will to address them, they often go untouched. And I suggest that all regulations promulgated by any executive body should be periodically reviewed and reapproved by the House. They need to go back through some sort of legislative process. It's not necessary that each of them be voted on separately. I think the leadership can group them up as they see fit. In this way, as control of the House shifts with the available inevitable flow of time, poor regulations can be culled from the herd to improve the nation's overall health. I think that's a good method for approaching the regulations in modern life. The second power that slowly crept into the domain of the executive without really any kind of proper check on it is that of emergency declarations. Currently, our system works in a way that would, I think, best be described fairly as insane. The president declares an emergency, and Congress has to reach a veto-proof threshold to end that emergency. During that emergency, the president is granted a whole host of powers that are normally solely those of Congress. This is really crazy. It's an affront to any idea of separation of powers. While granting temporary power to the executive may sometimes be necessary, that really should be done on a very limited basis and ought to be subject to renewal by the legislature periodically. I would give this power to the parliament, but allow for short-term emergencies to be declared by the president when parliament is unable to convene. Emergency declarations have slowly had their weight stripped from them while having their power increased substantially, and I think that's something that really desperately needs to be reversed. So the last part to talk about with the tricameral system, and unfortunately, sorry guys, probably the most boring, is the question of how does legislation actually get done. Now, I've given this a lot of thought. My original draft did have all three chambers signing off on the legislation. I ultimately decided that much process to routine legislation was going to be very difficult, and the reconciliation process was going to be really complicated. So I've decided on something that's a little bit different. It's a little more complicated, but I think it balances a lot of those pros and cons better. So generally, two chambers would be required to sign off on any bill. Bills for taxation and spending should originate at the national level at Parliament and be approved by the people, so the House. That seems pretty straightforward. I'd also want to craft some kind of language to prevent some of the games that goes on with this. Right now, the current Constitution does require that spending bills be drafted by the House, but frequently the Senate will find some old bill that the House did, amend it to destroy everything in the bill and replace it with new spending stuff and then send it back to the House. So they've essentially originated a spending bill without actually technically originating the bill. I think getting rid of that makes sense. Establishing and modifying executive agencies should be actions taken by the states collectively, so the Senate, for example, and then agreed upon by the Parliament. This seems a little odd, but consider something like the Department of Education, the much maligned Department of Education. Now, education is generally a right and duty preserved to the states. They're the ones in charge of education. There's no explicit federal role for it, but there logically could be a federal role if the states wanted there to be, right? So for a federal agency to exist that helped create standards and share best practices, I think viewing most federal agencies through that lens helps to establish the line between federal duties and state duties. And it stands to reason that the Senate would have that role. If 35 states don't think that it's worthwhile to have a Department of Education helping collaborations at the national level, then that probably should be taken into account. That seems fair. All other bills besides those would be introduced by any chamber. They have to be signed off on by both the House and the Senate. So that, look, take a step back. That means that a bill that originates in the Parliament would need all three chambers to agree. Bills that originate in the House and the Senate should be respected by the other body and allowed to have a vote. I think that's very, very important. I think one of the greatest sources of gridlock in today's politics, and we're seeing it right now, is the silent killing of popular bills that create political headaches for congressmen or might impinge upon their ability to fundraise. If the House passes a bill, it deserves a vote in the Senate. I think that should be a straight up or down vote. Now, the Senate is free to amend and adjust the bill, potentially creating a reconciliation process, but it deserves to have a vote, in my opinion. Additionally, and keeping the spirit of allowing votes on matters that leadership might prefer to go away quietly, each chamber should establish some sort of reasonable discharge petition. In recent years, the idea of the Hastert rule has become more prevalent. Both parties have employed this. It's named for the former Republican Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, but both parties have used this. And the rule basically says that the Speaker won't bring forth a bill that isn't supported by a majority of his own party. And that effect is to pull legislation pretty far to the extremes of the party and ignore bills that might get 80% of the minority and only 45% of the majority to support. That's pretty anathema to good governance. You're crafting artificial rules that serve only to ignore the will of the majority of representatives. A discharge petition is a formal process whereby a group of individuals can force a vote on something that the leadership doesn't want to have voted on. These shouldn't require a majority, obviously, but nor should they be abusable by a small minority. So, you know, it's not something like 10% can get this bill to the floor. Allowing the people in the middle of a political fight to exercise their will, regardless of what party extremes might think, really, I think, can only be considered a positive. And with that, we've concluded the discussion of the powers of Congress. Now, in the next thrilling installment of Jeff's Vanity Project, we'll explore the powers and limitations on Congress. We'll also look at the formal rights of the states, and we might even get into that no-confidence vote I teased a while back. Thanks, as always, for listening. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Federalist 2.0. My name is Jeff. You can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Please remember to like and subscribe. Apparently, giving 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really helps, so if you're using that service, please do that. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.